Good morning and welcome to our AA meeting on air on 104.6 Planet FM. My name is Harriet and I'm an alcoholic and I'll be chairing our meeting this morning. Please welcome our speakers today, Liz, Frankie and Joe, who will be sharing their experience, strength and hope with you all. Would you all like to help me open the meeting with the Serenity Prayer? God, grant me serenity to accept the things I cannot change. Courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. This is the preamble. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of people who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization or institution, does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. This morning I would like to welcome Liz to share their experience, strength and hope with us.
Thanks, Harriet. My name is Liz. I'm an alcoholic. My entry into AA was pretty brutal and traumatic. In early 2023, my 12-year-old daughter had some pretty major mental health issues. She'd been unwell for quite a long time, but early that year she became really violent and mainly towards me. We had a lot of police call-outs and phones with the mental health crisis team. And my relationship with my husband as well wasn't particularly good. It was definitely a harmful relationship. So I sort of spent most of that year just trying to fix things, you know, using my will to try and make everything go away, make my daughter healthy. I didn't really know what was going on with my husband, but I knew it was really bad. And then in about October, things just pretty much exploded. My husband left the house with my 12-year-old daughter. We had an 8 and 10-year-old children. So he left the house, and then a couple of days later, I had two policemen on my doorstep. I can visualize it right now, and they basically told me that I was in a family harm situation. My world really fell apart, and nothing really made sense. I fell apart basically. And I just used alcohol so much. To numb, I guess, the pain. I just wanted everything to go away, and I just physically broke. I couldn't really eat. I was lucky though. I had a couple of good friends. And I had my parents who came up from down south, and one night they tried an intervention, and I just remember sitting on the couch, and they were sitting on couches, and I was just so angry. I was like, how dare you come into my house and tell me, you know, that I've got a problem. And then I went to bed that night, and I remember I woke up the next morning, and my God, I don't know, I felt completely different. I felt weirdly calm, and I just pretty much just said yes. They sat me down. They talked about a rehab place that I could go to, and I just kept saying yes. My dad later said he couldn't believe it, but I felt like I had no other option. Life was just completely so unmanageable. There was nothing else I could do. So I went to rehab, and I went absolutely petrified. I was scared my husband would come and try and take my 8 and 10-year-old away. So it was definitely the scariest thing I've ever done. And I remember walking into the counselling room, and I saw the 12 steps up on the wall, And I didn't even realise I was doing the 12 steps. It was so funny, so ridiculous. But and I saw the word God, and I was like, man, that's not for me. But then I was told that, you know, it's take the word away, and it's really just about having a higher power, a belief in something. And at that time, for me, like, trust with people had just been sort of blown apart. So to know that I could put my faith and trust in something that wasn't a human was huge. And so I really let that up, you know. I held on to that, and I really got into the program while I was there. I loved it. I remember being told that I could never drink again, and that was a relief. My counsellor said it's like you've got, you know, an addiction to strawberries and you just can't eat them again. So I could do that, you know. And while I was in there, things were happening outside that I had no control over. And I just had to hand it over, you know. There was nothing else I could do. It was a bit of a survival tactic, really. Just having faith that things would work out. And when I came out, I walked back into a community, my kids' school community, that had been told that I was an alcoholic, a drug addict, abused as a child, and a whole lot of other things, most which weren't true. The alcoholic part was, though. But, you know, it didn't really bother me because, you know, I'd owned up, and I felt really good about doing that. And, you know, no one could take that away from me. And so there's quite a few things that really got me through. The Serenity Prayer. So the Serenity Prayer, in particular the first line, you know, God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change. There was so much going on in my life that, you know, I could just not do anything about. My 12-year-old had been cut off from me, having major hospital appointments. And so over and over I would just say, God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change. And that definitely helped. The one day at a time notion. So I didn't really think early on that that was for me because I was really lucky. The whole thing with alcohol just sort of fell away. It wasn't a thing anymore. But there were definitely days where I'd get consumed by fear. And sometimes that would make me angry, resentful. And so just getting through the day, you know, I'd just be like, write it out, Liz, write it out. You got this. So that was huge. And another thing that I do a lot today is something I just call the pause. So often my first reaction is the wrong one. So I just make myself stop. And pretty much most times my second thought, my second decision is the better one. And so today, oh my God, I'm just, I don't know, I'm really in love with AA. I'm a real AA nerd. I love it. I could never have gotten through without it. I have an AA toolkit, you know. It helps me every bloody day. And I have a community, and that's huge. So I love AA meetings. I go to them, and I have a community. And when things were really, really bad, I felt so, so alone. And I never have to be alone ever again. So, you know, I feel very lucky to be with AA. My kids have a sober mum. And the biggest thing for me is my freedom, which I have now. So thank you for letting me share.
Thank you so much, Liz. Frankie, would you like to share with us now, please?
Sure. Thanks, Harriet. I'm Frankie. I'm an alcoholic. I'm just over 6 months sober. And so I guess new-ish. to the programs. It's the I'm 49. It's the longest I've ever gone without a drink since I started drinking, by my calculations. So I don't know when my first drink was, what, 15, 16, something like that. And, you know, I think people, kids growing up these days, it's a different era. And certainly, you know, I'm from the UK originally, and growing up in the 80s, you know, mum drank at home and dad drank and mum's boyfriends drank. And as soon as we were old enough, we'd go to the pub and, you know, you go to the pub for like 4 or 5 pints. And I mean a proper pint, like a metric pint, on a Sunday before lunch. And if you didn't, you know, if you didn't have 4 pints before you went for a wee, you got, you know, you kind of got ribbed by the people in the pub. And that's just how it was, right? And then there wasn't really any information or education around moderation or not drinking. There weren't any alternatives. It just kind of was how it was, right? And then, you know, I started working in bars and restaurants and pubs from sort of 14, 15 onwards and through uni, and ended up graduating and then going back to work in bars. And that environment is like you serve people drinks all week, and then when you, the minute you've got a chance, you just go out and drink and party and celebrate. And actually, most of the places I work, you just drink through work anyway, because it's kind of what you did. And I carried on working in the drinks industry. And all of this was like at that, you know, for this time was really what I would consider to be in the fun zone. You know, it was sort of, it was excessive, but within the environment I was in, it kind of wasn't. Everyone was doing the same, so it's justifiable and normalized. And it was kind of fun and party and what have you. But you know what? One thing I've learned in AA is that it only gets worse. It's one of the terrifying realities that you have to face, because of course, like, I would imagine a lot of people on this journey with alcohol of understanding, you realize that your mission, and my mission for quite a long time, was to just try and keep a handle on it, you know? So we move from the fun zone into the sort of getting away with it zone, and then what I would call the problem zone. And by the end, it's like, I mean, I was moderating a huge amount, you know, long periods of abstinence, then a blowout, you know, and the amount of times I've stood in the shower the day after a blowout and gone, you know, kind of trying to get my head around it. It's that, you know, that baffling element of I've got so much that I'm in control of in my life, and I've got so much going for me, and there's no shortage of willpower or ability or skill or talent or intelligence, and yet I keep, how did I get myself here? You know, how did I find myself here on the back of another blowout? And so that quest for controlling, trying to minimize through moderation, abstinence, introducing rules, you know, X amount of days not drinking and then long periods off. But I could really see over time that when it was bad, it was getting worse. And the more I knew intellectually about it, it didn't make any difference whatsoever. So it's a really terrifying and horrible position to be in. And, you know, if I look back, drinking became, if I was, you know, if I had something to celebrate, you have a drink, right? And if I'm stressed, I have a drink. You know, my marriage fell apart, and I run my own business, and we went through some troubling times. And so it's, you know, you drink through that, and you drink through the stress of that, and you drink to cope with that. And then the occasional high points, you drink with that as well. But how it kind of ended for me before I got sober was, you know, I love listening to people share at meetings, because you really get the full perspective. And some people are out and about causing trouble in bars and getting into fights. And I really withdrew. After the breakup of my marriage, I bought a place. I live on my own. And that became almost like the perfect storm for retreating into my cave. So what my drinking looked like at the end was just isolation, loneliness, and drinking at the end of work to cope with a bad day turned into sometimes drinking in the morning to get through a day, sometimes not going to work at all. And, you know, and then I met someone at a party who, and I was, I learned the term white knuckling in AA, which is you're just trying to forcibly make it through using your willpower to not drink. And I was at a 50th birthday and not drinking. I got talking to a lady who'd been sober for 10 years, and she told me some wild stories. And it really, she really resonated with me. Her her frankness really appealed to me, and she was very bold in the way that she shared with me. It was like startlingly truthful. And you know, I white knuckled it a few more weeks, and then fell off the wagon and stood in the shower again, going, "How did I get to this place?" And I kind of knew. I'd also had a couple of close calls. Right, I had a couple of real close calls. I got stopped for speeding, and I think if I'd been breathalyzed, I might not have made it. It was in the morning, and I probably would have still been over from the night before. And the consequences of that for me with my business would just be, I mean, it would blow my entire world up. And I could just see, like I say, with my knowledge now, it only gets worse. I could really see that happening. And, you know, you do not have to go to jail. You do not have to hit another person with your car. You do not have to completely trash your life to go, "I can see where this is going." So I called that my rock bottom, and I called the person I met at a party, and she introduced me to someone who's very connected to AA, and who's now my sponsor. And, you know, I think the biggest difference for me in AA is the fellowship. You know, they're unbelievably the right people to help you with, it turns out, with being an alcoholic or other alcoholics. And I, you know, for someone who's worked in with drinks all of my life in my industry, it turns out I knew nothing, really nothing about what I was really dealing with. And so the experience and wisdom and support, the unconditional support of these other alcoholics, has just been incredible. And I think the biggest thing for me that I really return to, and it is one day at a time, is that my life had become unmanageable and that I had to surrender. You know, I really had to admit, and I have to admit on a daily basis, that A, I can't do this on my own, and B, that it's unmanageable. And I really have to consistently retire any romantic notion I have that I can drink normally or moderate. And I fantasize about that bottle of Pinot Noir. I love cooking with that steak. And I just have to remind myself it's a fantasy. But I'm here sober, appreciative and grateful for the program, the fellowship, and particularly the people in it. So thank you for the opportunity to share.
Brilliant. Thank you so much, Frankie. Joe, would you like to share with us, please?
Hi, my name is Joe, and I am an alcoholic. I have been celebrating 8 years sober this week, which I never, ever dreamed would be possible or even be a dream. My identity was pretty wrapped up in alcohol and drugs from my first lick of booze at 11 years old. I had gone door knocking in my neighbourhood looking for a summer job and turned up at a bottling factory. And so my first paid job was sticking stickers on booze bottles and licking my fingers. And that was a little bit exciting. And then, you know, I lived in sort of a small suburb, and at night my friends and I would sneak out, and we met at the dairy one evening, and someone had stolen the Jaguar off the Jaguar car. And I arrived as the boys had just been busted stealing the Jag. And that, so the girls, you know, I'd gone to meet the girls. They hadn't shown up yet, and I was told, "Run." I was like, "Oh, okay, off we go." By this time, I was either still 11 or 12, because it was before high school. And next thing you know, we're darting through the park, and so the car couldn't get us. And someone said, "Oh, I know where such and such's family keep their booze. Let's go get some." And it was in a shed outside their house. So someone picked the lock, and next minute we're at someone else's house, and I'm thinking, oh, cool, I'm going to try this wine. And I know that I'll be drunk when that lemon over there starts moving around. And sure enough, it started moving around, and I thought, oh, cool, this is interesting. And I just felt free. I felt so free and warm and fuzzy. And, you know, got to 5 a.m., and I was like, oh, better walk me home. So I'd actually got myself into kind of a scary situation because it was an older person that, an older man, you know, who had his own flat, you know, that was hanging around with these kids stealing booze. So, you know, at that time, I didn't black out that first drunk, and I kind of could still see the situation I got myself into. He did try to put me into his bed, but, you know, I did say, walk me home. But it was still so exciting. And then, you know, I snuck back in and to the house and went to bed, wrote about it in my diary, and thought, I want to try that again. I don't know when my next drink was. It would have been pretty soon after. We used to go to Christmas in the Park, and that was an event in a big field, and the museum was where the museum is, and that's where all the kids would go with their rocket fuel. You know, the parents' liquor cabinet, put it in the drink bottle, whatever we could. So, I don't know, a bit of Sambuca and vodka and blah. And then that's where, you know, the blackouts and the partying really sort of started tapping, and I thought that was normal. And, you know, fast forward, I don't know, we'd be taking wine to school, and then, oh, God, I moved to the UK, and I was 18, and as has been shared, it was pretty normal to have those 5 pints before going to the bathroom, and surrounding myself with other people who drank more than I did, blacked out as much as I did, or maybe didn't drink as much as I did, but were still in the same environment. Yeah, things turned pretty ugly, but I didn't really realise how bad they'd been until I sobered up, and, you know, I'm still sort of untangling the pieces now, because one thing that happens when you're an alcoholic and the bottle is your best friend, you learn to lie to yourself and to everybody else around you. And I, you know, also took jobs where booze was payment, you know, and some cash. And, you know, clubs and bars and party, party, party. And then, you know, some retail jobs where it was cold, very cold in London in the in the winter in the shops. And maybe someone had we had flasks of whiskey. And I would hear people when I came into the rooms, or what I thought an alcoholic was somebody that was always shaking or at a park bench, you know, with a brown paper bag. And that wasn't me, because I think I just didn't notice I was shaking. And if I was sitting on a park bench with a brown paper bag, I just don't remember. So, I partied my way into my husband's life. We did get married when we were sober. We knew each other from party times and came together in more party times, had a baby, got to the point where I couldn't really juggle the baby in the bottle. And she had been diagnosed with a very strange medical condition, which, of course, I decided I should become a scientist to investigate why this had happened. And again, you know, the bottle in the books now. I couldn't do it anymore. I'd back myself into a corner with how my drinking had been affecting everybody else around me and the emergency hospital trips we would have to make. I could no longer plan for when my next drink would be because something could happen at any moment. And I am so grateful for that because I found myself into these rooms and I found a sponsor and a home group and I started working the steps. I now understand that I have an allergy to alcohol, which means I have an abnormal reaction to the juice, and I have to have a belief that there is something more powerful than me to get me through and to take that pause and listen for the next right thing. That the reaction isn't the answer, and the slow and steady response, and the fellowship, the group, other people's stories, and staying sober one day at a time, just one day at a time, is leading to a life that I want to be part of. So thank you for letting me share.
Thank you so much. That's all the time we have today. Thank you again to Liz, Frankie and Joe for joining us in the studio today and to all of you for listening. We are on air each Sunday at 10:45 a.m. here on 104.6 Planet FM. If you or anyone you know is in need of help from AA, please either call on 0800 AA Works, that's 0800 229 6757, 0800 229 6757, or visit the AA website, www.aa.org.nz, where you can find lots of information. Finally, you can find today's recording and others on the Planet FM website, www.planetaudio.org.nz, under the program name AA On Air. And finally, could you all join me now in closing this meeting with the Serenity Prayer? God.
Grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and wisdom to know the difference.
Never miss your favourite shows again. Click onto planetaudio.org.nz.
There are Citizens Advice Bureau throughout the Auckland region. If you have a problem, give your local Citizens Advice Bureau a call. They're in the know and their service is free. Their friendly volunteers are trained to help you with free legal services and budgeting advice, consumer affairs and social problems, confidentially. Look under C in the phone book for your local Citizens Advice Bureau. You can be certain of a friendly welcome and confidential service.
Whether you call it Aotearoa, New Zealand, New Zealand or Nova Zelandia, it's worth knowing the history of the place most of us call home. Starting 100 million years ago and bringing us right through to modern day, the Aotearoa History Show explores some of the forces that have shaped this land and its people, from the geographical to the social and political. Produced by RNZ, the Aotearoa History Show airs here on 104.6 Planet FM every Monday at 2:35 p.m. And you can hear the full series anytime online by visiting the series and podcasts page at rnz.co.nz or using your favourite podcasting app.
Property Matters, proudly brought to you by Barfoot & Thompson.
Join me, Stephen Dallow, each week as I chat with guests across the property investment landscape and answer your questions as landlords and tenants. We're on air Mondays 4:15 p.m. on Planet FM 104.6 or download the podcast at barfoot.co.nz/property matters.
Property Matters.
This is 104.6 Planet FM. Join AA Meeting on Air next Sunday morning at 10:45. And if you'd like to listen to this program again, go to our website, planetaudio.org.nz/AA Meeting on Air. All one word.